All right, hello and welcome to the Friday edition of American Hit Radio, the only show that is guaranteed to bring you 5 seconds of dead air time every single time we go on. Wednesdays and Fridays, I guarantee it. Joe, it's not you, it's me. You know what it is? It's our theme song. The way it cues up, there's a little bit of buzz from the amplifier from when I recorded that song with my whole band. And the song that we use is our theme song, playing in the background now.
Right.
And every time we hit the play button, you got to basically let that buzz happen. I love it. I've learned to love the 5 seconds of silence before our shows. Anyway, it's a beautiful
day.
It's
the only 5 seconds of silence you'll ever get out of Tom Ryan.
You can tell I'm glad it's Friday. I'm laughing. Oh, my God. The week is over.
Oh, I'm so jovial.
The best thing about Friday is that I also get to, you know, I get to basically ease my way into the weekend by coming in here and basically playing and talking
about music. Yeah, you
wouldn't
want it to be a shock to your system.
Oh, it would be horrible. Oh, I don't think I'd be able to handle
shudder.
It. Shudder. So this is like work, only it's fun work. Fridays, of course, is the How Music Changed day. That's where we basically discuss some of the most important artists and events that have happened in the history of recorded music. We just, last week, started a new topic. We are looking at Burt Bacharach as our point of interest with this series. This is actually part number 142 out of 250 different subjects we plan to cover. This is show number two, as I said, since last week was show number one, dedicated to Burt Bacharach. With this show, we're doing most of these in chronological order. We usually do. I think we just almost always have for most of these topics. So where we are now, basically, Burt is at the point where he's kind of at the end of his relationship with Marlene Dietrich. Mm-hmm. And by relationship, you know, I mean her musical
director. Yeah, he was touring
director.
With her.
He was touring with her for a good number of years. And the hits that were beginning to develop from the previous show were now causing him to become well known enough that he was now in demand as a writer.
Right.
And it was, you know, took a decent amount of hard work. So he eventually ended up going independent and working on his own. And now he was dedicating himself exclusively to the thought of writing hits, whether some of them ended up on the R&B charts, a good number of them did. We played a couple of tracks that actually ended up on the country charts as well.
Right.
Pop charts, etc. So, let's start with a quote. I'm rather lucky coincidence that Burt Bacharach's autobiography has just been released just before we started this series. A total coincidence, quite honestly, because I had laid out this arrangement of shows years ago. No idea that this could have, you know, that it could have been so
it's
lucky.
It's coinciding
in this case
with a lot of Burt Bacharach stuff that's going on in the world.
An awful lot lately.
Right.
It's
just how
things
the
work
universe
out.
Works. Yeah, it attracts certain particles.
Me being one of them.
Yeah.
A particle. Well, I'm going to read excerpts from the book. We can hear, you know, Burt in his own words or in his own thoughts regarding the various parts of his career. And here he is now basically discussing the time period of 1962 in this part. Even though I was now writing a lot of R&B material, Hal and I were still working for Famous Music, the publishing company that hired him, that he was having terrible luck with at first.
Initially, yes.
Right. They asked us to come up with a song for a movie Paramount Pictures was about to release called The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, starring John Wayne and James Stewart, and directed by John Ford. It was a very hard song for me to write, and it took me a long time to finish it. Hal wrote the lyrics first, so I had to come up with music to fit the words and figure out where to put the hook. The song has an odd structure because there are two verses before the hook comes in, and the hook itself is the man who shot Liberty Valance, he shot Liberty Valance, he was the bravest of them all. I finally finished writing it while I was hanging out on the beach for a couple of days in Montauk, Long Island.
How about that?
I thought I'd mention that since it brings us back to home. I had a girl with me, but I couldn't enjoy being there with her because my mind was on this song rather than her. Here is that track by Gene, as performed by Gene Pitney, who eventually recorded it, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance.
Thank you. When Liberty Valance rode to town, the women folk would hide, they'd hide. When Liberty Valance walked around, the men would step aside. Because the point of a gun was the only law that Liberty understood. When it came to shooting straight and fast, he was mighty good. From out of the east, a stranger came, a law book in his hand. Oh, man. The kind of a man the West would need to tame a troubled land. 'Cause the point of a gun was the only law that Liberty understood. When it came to shooting straight and fast, he was mighty good. Many a man would face his gun, and many a man would fall. The man who shot Liberty Valance, he shot Liberty Valance. He was the bravest of them all. The love of a girl can make a man stay on when he should go. Stay on. Just trying to build a peaceful life where love is free to grow. But the point of a gun was the only law that Liberty understood. When the final showdown came at last, a law book was no good. Alone and afraid, she prayed that he'd return that fateful night. Oh, that night. When nothing she said could keep her man from going out to fight. From the moment a girl gets to be full grown, the very first thing she learns, when two men go out to face each other, only one returns. The bravest of them all. The man who shot Liberty Valance, he shot Liberty Valance. He was the bravest of them all.
At this point in time, Burt Bacharach still was not producing all of his own sessions.
It's a sin.
He was occasionally directing a couple of them, but not producing them. And in this instance, it was actually Jerry Lieber who was in the studio who had suggested that violin that's used for the riff.
Because
Peter originally intended to use a different instrument that was there. But since he wasn't the producer, it wasn't for him to say at this point yet. Rather, the other thing that's unusual is that the song obviously was written for the movie, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, yet it was never used in the movie.
Oh.
Even though the song became a big hit for Gene Pitney, it was number four on the pop charts in 1962. So yet another big, in fact, it was the biggest hit in Gene Pitney's career up until this point. So another, you know, quite winning success for Burt Bacharach there.
Score.
Now, at the same, he had a very strange, love life. He had been married and divorced already by this time. I don't spend too much time on the personal stuff because that's not really my area of interest, unless it somehow does
affect the career.
Right, affect the music specifically, you know, that part of the career. So I'll gloss over just a little bit here because I think it does relate to this next song. There was a woman named Slim Brandy who he was dating. Apparently a bit of a knockout. And he was, you know, she had been married, as she says, to a very wealthy man, and she had bumped into Burt after they already had, you know, a fling for a while, and then they had gone their own ways. Now she's married, and she saw Burt when he was working with Marlene, and it was just one of those moments, but it sort of like rekindled
the romance
a little bit, right? Because it was like, you know, eventually she did get divorced, and she was like at a table at Basin Street East, she said, when Burt walked in with his parents and sat down at the table right next to her.
Oh.
So at that point, the whole thing basically started up again, and she moved into an apartment that was like across the hall from him and wherever, I think in Manhattan at the time. And she was waiting for him to
propose,
but, you know, after a couple of months, but he wasn't interested in that. And it's really odd. I mean, she eventually even became pregnant and they were excited about, you know, having the baby. But then, you know, he bought a ring and everything else. And then eventually she said that he started to get edgy and they began to bicker. He was like drinking a little bit more. Maybe he felt trapped by the relationship. Eventually, she actually aborted the baby without even letting him know.
Woo.
Which obviously ended that relationship.
Mm.
Somewhere in the middle of that, she had to go to Mexico to get her divorce. And that apparently triggered the idea for a song in his mind. Even though he's not the lyricist and he wrote the music, it's interesting that he decided to write a song for the Drifters entitled Mexican Divorce. It was used as the B-side of a song that never charted. So it really wasn't a hit. So I'm breaking two rules here. They're not really rules, but I intend to play mostly...
Rules are meant to be broken.
Right, right. I intend to play mostly top 40 hits written by Burt Bacharach. No sense in getting too deep or obscure. And I also intend to play original versions of songs rather than later remakes, although there are places where I'll have exceptions to that. I think it's going to be...
Is this one?
Yeah, this is one.
Oh, okay.
This is a song that was, like I said, I don't have the Drifters version, but I think it'd be interesting to play some remakes as they appeared later on, as other people copy them, because it shows some of his influence and just how far Burt Bacharach's material did reach. Uh-huh. So I think I'm going to do that from time to time as we go forward. In this case, the artist who is covering the song happens to be Ry Cooder, who did a version of this song on his album Paradise and Lunch. So then here is Ry Cooder performing his cover of the Drifters' version of Burt Bacharach's tune, Mexican Divorce.
It's a sin for you to get a Mexican divorce. Down below El Paso lies Juarez. Mexico is different, like the trail over sea. Cross the Rio Grande and you will find an old adobe house where you leave your past behind. One day married, the next day free. Broken hearts for you and me. Takes all time for you to get a Mexican divorce. Well, I came into this lonely house last night. I looked out all my windows, but I couldn't find one light. I found you on that road to Mexico, and now, my love, I beg, please, oh, please don't go. One day married, next day must be wrong. It's a sin for us to get a stay free. Broken heart for you and me. It's a sin for you to get a Mexican divorce.
Ry Cooder version of that song. I believe it was recorded sometime around 1972 by Ry Cooder of Mexican Divorce. Here's Burt Bacharach talking about that song and about this point in time in his own life when the song was written. Bob Hilliard and I wrote a song for the Drifters called Mexican Divorce, which came out in February 1962 as the flip side of a record that never even made it onto the charts. Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller really liked the song, but they were so busy running Redbird Records that they asked me to rehearse the background singers for them in my office. There were four girls there, and they all sounded so great that I couldn't tell which one was the best singer. The four girls were Sissy Houston, her nieces Dee Dee and Dionne Warwick, and their cousin Myrna Smith. Right from the first time I ever saw Dionne, I thought she had a very special kind of grace and elegance that made her stand out. She had really high cheekbones and long legs, and she was wearing sneakers and her hair was in pigtails. There was just something in the way she carried herself that caught my eye. To me, Dionne looked like she could be a star. About 6 weeks after we cut Mexican Divorce, Dionne got in touch with me and asked if she could come in and make some demos with Hal and me. We took Dionne into the studio and had her cut It's Love That Really Counts and Make It Easy on Yourself. When we took the demos to Florence Greenberg, she liked It's Love That Truly Counts enough to let me record it with the Shirelles, but she had no interest in Make It Easy on Yourself. An A&R man named Calvin Carter, whose sister Vivian and brother-in-law James Bracken ran VJ Records in Chicago, one of the first black-owned and operated labels, came to the Brill Building one day to look for material, and someone gave him Make It Easy on Yourself. Calvin took the demo back to Chicago and played it for Jerry Butler, who thought it was a hit just the way Dionne was singing it.
Wow.
When Calvin told him Scepter was not going to put it out, they decided to cut the song on VJ. Unlike Luther Dixon at Scepter, Calvin Carter and Jerry Butler told me, "You get the musicians, you conduct, you make the record."
Nice.
VJ put up the money for the date, and Calvin Carter and Jerry Butler flew into New York for the session. For the first time ever in the studio, I had maximum control, and it all went pretty well. Jerry Butler always liked to lay back and sing behind the beat, so I had to push him a little to get what I wanted on the lead vocal. Slim Brandy had come with me to the studio that night. She had a great suntan and was wearing an incredible orange dress. She looked so drop-dead gorgeous that Jerry couldn't stop staring at her. Calvin Carter finally said over the intercom, "Hey, Jerry, keep your mind on the song, man." Everybody cracked up. And although we only cut one song that night, Make It Easy on Yourself went to number 20 on the pop chart. Here is that track as sung by Jerry Butler.
So very hard to do. If you really love him, then there's nothing I can do. Don't try to spare my feelings, just tell me that we're through. And make it easy on yourself. Make it easy on yourself. Cause breaking up is so very hard to do. And if the way I hold you can't compare to his caress, no words of consolation will make me miss you less.
Make it easy on yourself. Jerry Butler, a new character in the story of Burt Bacharach. The one we're going to be hearing from most in this show is Gene Pitney, as he is actually his next stop. And here's why. Let's, again, reading from Burt's book. By saying, make the record yourself, Calvin Carter gave me my first big break. After I did that session, I knew I never wanted to work any other way again, because by actually being in the studio while the record was being cut, I could protect my material and make the song sound the way I heard it in my head and then played it.
Awesome.
I could start with a framework and then evolve from that as the musicians heard the song and then played it. So very cool. Makes sense, obviously. Very obvious. Now on to the next track. Hal and I wrote Only Love Can Break a Heart specifically for Gene Pitney. The melody doesn't sound like something I would have written without having first seen the lyrics, and the song has a very odd structure. Hal must have given me the line, last night I hurt you, but darling, remember this, because the hook, which is almost like the chorus, comes in four bars after the song starts. It's an unusual form, but that never bothered me as long as it made sense. Instead of making a demo of it, Hal and I went over to 1650 Broadway so I could play the song for Gene on the piano. Then I wrote the arrangement, and you can hear Gene whistling over the opening section. The thing about Gene was he always came to the studio prepared, so this wasn't one of my beat-up-the-singer sessions. The song didn't take long to do, and I walked out of the studio feeling good, thinking, wow, this sounds like a hit. Only Love Can Break a Heart went to number two on the pop chart for a week, and the funny thing was that He's a Rebel was number one. I always wondered why nobody has ever cut Only Love Can Break a Heart again, particularly a country artist. Here is that track.
Only love can break a heart. Only love can mend it again. Last night I heard you, but darling,
yeah. Now, while that song was climbing the chart, Burt Bacharach is now able to hear his own material coming back at him over the radio with regularity. And
nice
you would
job.
Think that that would be like a really great thing, you know. Like,
you would.
A very positive experience. But Bacharach says that for the most part, for him, it was a miserable experience.
Why?
He said that every time he heard the song over the radio, it always sounded much worse than he expected it to sound.
You're always your own worst critic.
Yeah, and he was like, he would go berserk on the record plants that were pressing the records, telling them that they were ruining his music. And he was freaking
wow.
out about second-guessing some of his own ideas about production. He was really, you know, he was getting nitpicking to the point where he was driving himself crazy.
Sounds
again,
like
you know,
it.
Here's him talking about that, though. I think if his reaction was, you know, rough on it, it was nothing compared to the girl who sang the demo. Here's what I'm talking about. The way I felt about Make It Easy on Yourself was nothing compared to the way Dion reacted to it. She was already possessive about what Hal and I wrote and got really upset with us because she felt we had given her song away to someone else, which was definitely not the way it happened. Hal and I wanted to work with her, so we signed Dion to a production deal with a company we formed, and then we went to Florence Greenberg, who agreed to let Dion record with us on Scepter. The story Dion likes to tell is that while we were arguing with her about Jerry Butler having done Make It Easy on Yourself, she said, "Don't make me over, man." And a week later, the two of us brought her a song with that title. Hal never bothered to correct her version of the story, but if you had asked him about it, he would have told you that Dion never really said that to him. What made Dion different from a lot of the artists we worked with was that she had minored in piano in college and could read music, which was a big plus for me.
Nice.
The more Hal and I worked with her, the more we saw what she could do. In Don't Make Me Over, a song that goes from 12-8 to 6-8, I had her sing an octave and a sixth, and she did it with her eyes closed. Dion could sing that high, and she could sing that low. She could sing that strong, and she could sing that loud. Yes, she could also be soft and delicate. As our music relationship evolved, I began to see her potential and realized I could take more risks and chances. To me, her voice had all the delicacy and mystery of sailing ships and bottles. Here's that first single released by Dionne Warwick, Don't Make Me Over.
Don't make me over. Don't make me over, now that you know how I adore you. Don't pick on the things I say, the things I do. Just love me with all my faults, the way that I love you. I'm begging you, don't make me over. And hold me tight.
First, and I still think it's one of her best recordings.
Home run.
She's so powerful on that. You know, she doesn't really use that monstrous power on most of her other singles.
Yeah.
And she really belts that one out. Here's Dionne Warwick's quote regarding that session, actually. "Don't Make Me Over was my very first recording, and I still remember it vividly because we literally did 32 takes.
Holy moly. Whoa.
Bert kept saying, can you give me one more? I think you've got one more in you. And it was not as if he was fixing one or two notes or a couple of words. It was the entire song, each time, full out.
Oh, my goodness.
That's the way it was back then. You know,
yeah.
Not as easy to edit. Can a singer do 32 takes? I don't know about anyone else, but I certainly did. Everybody was in the studio at the same time, so all the musicians and backup singers were doing this as well. And excuse Bert me. Wound up using the second take.
Oh, no. Kill you.
Here's Bert talking now again from the book. We cut the song at Bell Sound, and when Hal and I brought it to Florence Greenberg, she cried, not because of how much she liked the record. Florence cried because of how much she didn't like it.
Really?
Both of us were really taken aback by her reaction, but there was nothing we could do or say to make her change her mind. She wound up putting out Don't Make Me Over as the B-side of I Smiled Yesterday, a song we had cut at the same session. Fortunately for us all, disc jockeys flipped the record over and began playing Don't Make Me Over, which went to number 21 on the pop chart and number 5 on the R&B chart.
Had to teach her a lesson, huh?
Right. My first name was misspelled as Bert with an E 3 different times on the label, and because Scepter mistakenly put a W into Dionne's last name, which was Warwick, I did not know that, she became Dionne Warwick. From then on. Eventually, even Florence Greenberg came around. Not because she liked the record, not at all. Florence started loving it because she saw it go up on the charts.
Yeah.
Now, just a little bit later, let's see. Find my place here. Actually, the next track I wanted to cover was a song that was performed by Bobby Vinton. And I have the story here. I just got to find my place because it's very difficult for
Bobby
me to...
Bobby Vinton, the keep... Polish priest. What do they call him? The Polish prince, right?
Is that what they said?
I think so. I think that's what they used to refer to him as. That was his little nickname.
Yeah, I guess that's because of the connection with him in Las Vegas and such.
I have no idea where that came from. I just remember hearing that.
Ah, I found my spot. Thank you.
Okay.
In the spring of 1963, I took a song Hal and I had written called Blue on Blue to Bobby Vinton, which had started out as a trumpet player and band leader with Dick Clark's Caravan of Stars. I don't know that he did that. He was a trumpet player.
How about that?
Roses Are Red, My Love had been a number one song for him, but after 4 of his singles in a row failed to hit the charts, he was looking desperately for a hit. I played the song for Bobby, but when he told me he wanted half the publishing on it, I turned around and started to walk out of his office. Bobby ran after me and said, "Hey, Bert, I'm just joking. It's a great record. Let's record it." Here it is, Blue on Blue.
Blue on blue, heartache on heartache. Blue on blue, now that we are through. Blue on blue, heartache on heartache. And I find I can't get over losing you. I walk along the street we used to walk, 2 by 2 lovers pass, and as they're passing by, I could die, 'cause you're not here with me. And now the trees are bare, there's sadness in the air, and I'm as blue as I can be. Blue on blue, heartache on heartache, blue on blue, now that we are through. Blue on blue, heartache on heartache, and I find I can't get over losing you. Night after lonely night, we meet in dreams as I run to your side. You wait with open arms that now are closed to me. Through a veil of tears, your vision disappears, and I'm as blue as I can be. Blue on blue, heartache on heartache, now that we are through. Blue on blue, heartache on heartache, and I find I can't get over losing you. Blue on blue, heartache on heartache, blue on blue, now that we are through.
Blue on Blue went to number 3 on the pop charts. The real significance, as again, reading Burt Bacharach's words here, the real significance of Blue on Blue, though, is that after Hal and I wrote it, we stopped working with other people. After spending 11 years together, we decided to get married as songwriters and only work with one another. Let me remind you, you're listening to American Hit Radio on WHPC 90.3 FM. Heidi and I are here every Wednesday and Friday at 5, doing what we are doing now. On Friday specifically, we call the show How Music Changed, as we cover specific artists and the history of that artist. We've been doing this for quite a while. If you're interested in this series or in hearing other shows from this series, we are saving them all on our website. And it's pretty awesome that we're generating more and more interest, I think, the longer we go on, as we are well over a million listens. It's pretty awesome. I appreciate that. It's really cool that people are checking it out, getting a lot of decent feedback. I'm happy to get feedback either way. So if you check out the website, you can tell me what you think there, too, because you can contact us. That's fantastic. Or you can just listen. The cool thing about it is you can listen to whatever show you want to whenever you want to, because they're just all there for you to play on demand.
Do it as you like.
Exactly. So you can go as you please. Check it out, though. The URL is AmericanHitNetwork.com. And you can just search on the show name, American Hit Radio. We'll come right up, and you'll see all the shows right there. All right, then. Let's get back to our history of Burt Bacharach. This is part 2 in our series. And I mentioned that Gene Pitney was pretty much the featured artist for today's show. We're going to go with 2 of his songs back-to-back now. Here's Hal David, the marriage partner, so to speak, in this songwriting pairing now, because he is now more or less the wordsmith.
Committed to each other.
The committed wordsmith for Burt Bacharach going forward from this point on. Here's Hal David's words. In the early days, around the time we did 24 Hours from Tulsa, I would sometimes write short stories in a black and white high school composition notebook and then write lyrics from that. Doing this really helped me because in the beginning, I used to wander all over the place with my work, especially when I was telling a story, and doing this enabled me to keep myself on track. Now, this is really interesting that they are writing these songs and they're providing them to Gene Pitney. Gene mm-hmm. Pitney was quite a successful songwriter in his own right.
Really?
I mean, he had written Hello Mary Lou for Ricky Nelson. He wrote Rubber Ball Bobby V. He wrote He's a Rebel for the Crystals. So in this sense, Pitney was working from both angles as a great songwriter, but because he had that incredibly high-pitched voice with a very, quite a range. And Burt Bacharach tended to write songs that required somebody with a decent range. So here are 2 Gene Pitney songs that were back-to-back hits for him, the first reaching number 21 on the pop charts, the second reaching number 17. We'll hear True Love Never Runs Smooth first, and we'll segue that into 24 Hours from Tulsa.
True love stand beside me all the while, no matter what goes wrong. Separately we're weak, together we'll be strong. For true love never runs smooth, but I don't care, 'cause true love is worth all the pain, the heartaches and tears that we may share. When the world outside my arms is pulling us apart, rest your lips to mine and hold me with your heart. For true love never runs smooth, that's what they say, but true love is worth all the pain, the heartaches and tears we have to pay. That's what they say, but true love is worth all the pain, the heartaches and tears we have to pay.
Something happened to me while I was driving home, and I'm not the same anymore. Oh, I was only 24 hours from Tulsa, only one day away from your arms. I saw a welcoming light and stopped to rest for the night, and that is when I as I pulled in outside of the small motel, she was there. And so I walked up to her, asked where I could get something to eat, and she showed me where. Oh, I was only 24 hours from Tulsa, only one day away from your arms. She took me to the cafe, I asked her if she would stay. She said, okay. Oh, I was only 24 hours from Tulsa, one day away from your arms. The jukebox started to play, and nighttime turned into day. As we were dancing closely, all of a sudden I lost control as I held her charms. And I caressed her, kissed her, told her I'd die before I would let her out of my arms. Oh, I was only 24 hours from Tulsa, only one day away from your arms. I hate to do this to you, but I love somebody new. What can I do when I
can never, never, never go home again.
Wow. It's like a love story.
Such drama.
Really?
The thing is, first of all, the production of that song is really interesting to note. I mean, how many songs can you think of that feature dobro and trumpet?
Right.
You know, it's, and with the Bayonne beat.
Well, you know what I said, the first note of the song.
Well, yeah. It's
Down in the Boondocks.
Absolutely. Now, the thing is, Down in the Boondocks came out 2 years later. They lifted that Down in the Boondocks almost wholesale. Billy Joe Royal, the arrangement for Down in the Boondocks. Burt Bacharach calls it the most obvious form of flattery is when you copy something blatantly. But that Down in the Boondocks is a blatant copy of the intro of that song. Put
yes.
the very beginning of that track, Joe. Do you mind? Just like the first 5 seconds. I'm very, because just listen to it and think Down in the Boondocks, and it's kind of hard to not hear it.
Let's see.
Down in the Boondocks. It's so obvious. Oh, that's cool. Thanks. Anyway. So anyway, Gene Pitney is now, you know, very happy. 2 songs, like I said, one at number 21, one at number 17. So his career is going along well. Meanwhile, again, words from the book written by Burt Bacharach, which, by the way, is entitled Anyone Who Had a Heart. Hal and I were really starting to hit our stride with the R&B material we were writing, but we also kept coming up with songs like Wives and Lovers, a 3/4 jazz waltz that Jack Jones recorded. I never liked the way he cut it because that wasn't how I thought the song should sound orchestrally, but Jack did win a Grammy for Best Pop Performance for the song. Wives and Lovers was also covered by people like Frank Sinatra with the Count Basie Band, Stan Getz, Nancy Wilson, Lena Horne, and Ella Fitzgerald, who cut it with Duke Ellington. Here is that first original version, though, by Jack Jones, his version of Wives and Lovers.
Hey, little girl, comb your hair, fix your makeup. Soon he will open the door. Don't think because there's a ring on your finger, you needn't try anymore. For wives should always be lovers too. Run to his arms the moment he comes home to you. I'm warning you. Day after day, there are girls at the office, and men will always be men. Don't send him off with your hair still in curlers. You may not see him again. For wives should always be lovers too. Run to his arms the moment he comes home to you. He's almost here. Something pretty, something you'd wear to go through the city and dim all the lights, pour the wine, start the music. Time to get ready for love. Dim all the lights, pour the wine, start the music. Time to get ready for love. Time to get ready. Time to get ready for love. Time to get ready.
Making plans for tonight after hearing that song.
I'm ready.
That was the biggest hit of the Jack Jones' career. Went to number 14 on the pop charts.
I'm sure a lot of people must have loved that song.
The thing is, obvious, yes, you know, it's It's a mature subject. I mean, it's obviously not teeny bopper material at all. It's a pop song, but it's a mature pop song, and it's sexy. A lot of these, you know, there's an underlying sexiness to a lot of these songs that he was writing. Even like, you know, Make It Easy on Yourself and such. Maybe more than a little bit sexist as well.
Yeah.
No doubt about how men will always be men and, you know, you've got to dress up for him. It's like it's all about, you know, you better be careful. If you're not sexy, he's going to, you know, he's going
to
cheat.
He's going to have a roving eye.
Anyway, back to the topic, Matt, to the topic at hand. The next track that we're going to want to cover. I'll let Burt Bacharach tell us in his own words. Hal and I were also trying to come up with new material for Dion. While the three of us were rehearsing in my apartment one day for an upcoming recording session, I played her a song that kept changing time signatures, going from 4-4 to 5-4, and then with a 7-8 bar at the end on the turnaround. It seemed really natural to me that way, and the last thing on my mind was to ever make a song that would be difficult for musicians to play or for an audience to understand. This is one of those songs that flows really easily to the ear,
mm-hmm.
but playing it is a bear. This song, you can it's really, really difficult to play. He talks about the recording session. Along with Sissy Houston, Dee Dee Warwick, and Myrna Smith, I brought in three white girl singers who were making a lot more money at the time doing jingles than any of us were ever going to see from a record. One of them was Linda November, who could sing all the way up into the stratosphere. She and the other two white girls would walk into the studio, hang up their mink coats, and be ready to go to work. On Don't Make Me Over, I had Sissy, Dee Dee, and Myrna singing in the lower register, with the white girls singing on top of them. If you listen to the record, you can hear the soul on the bottom and the altitude coming from the white girls. And also, listen to these how the time signature bounces around. 5-4 is a very unusual time signature in a pop song, but especially when you use it as a fleeting thing to just get that one extra beat in a certain section, and then to have another message be in 7-8, where you cut off half of a beat. Nutty, but it's the way Burt Bacharach was writing, and
okay. You
can't argue with success. Here's Anyone Who Had a Heart.
Anyone who ever loved could look at me and know that I love you. Anyone who ever dreamed could look at me and know I dream of you. Knowing I anyone who had a heart would take me in his arms and love me too. You couldn't really have a heart and hurt me like you hurt me, and it's untrue. What am I to do? Every time you go away, I always say, this time it's goodbye, dear. Loving you the way I do, I take you back. Without you, I die, dear. Knowing I love you so. Thank you.
All right. Around this time when Dion released this track, there was an awful lot of, all of a sudden, all of her hits were becoming hugely famous in England by other people, and it was really beginning to drive them crazy. Almost all of her hits were getting, like, usurped by them.
Right.
Here's Burt Bacharach again talking about that. Although I had no idea how it happened at the time, Brian Epstein, the manager of the Beatles, bought a copy of Dion's record of Anyone Who Had a Heart while he was in New York and took it back with him to London. He gave it to George Martin, who thought the song would be perfect for Shirley Bassey, but instead he wound up cutting it at Abbey Road Studios with Cilla Black.
Hmm.
The song became a hit in England, and Dion really got bent out of shape about that.
I don't blame her.
Dion's quote, "I say frequently that if the organ player had made a mistake or if I had coughed in the middle of the song, Cilla would have coughed and the organ player would have played a wrong note." That was how verbatim they copied exactly what
wow.
we had recorded. Although I knew how Dion felt, this is Bert again, about what Cilla had done, neither Hal nor I had any control over who covered what we wrote, so there was really nothing either of us could have done about that. Elvis Costello offers an interesting perspective on it. Here's a quote from Elvis Costello. "The way music was set up in England back then meant there were two things that conditioned hearing it differently than in America. One was the needle time restriction, which put a strict limit on the amount of recorded music that could be played per week on the BBC, which was the main source of music other than Radio Luxembourg. This meant that a lot of what was played on the air in England was heard, transposed, or filtered through dance bands and ensembles that played live on the BBC. The second factor was that there were no global releases in those days, so there was a delay of up to 6 weeks between the release of the record in America and its release in England. A record had time to be a hit in America, and then it would be picked up by people in the UK who had their ears tuned to the American charts. I've heard Dion on this subject a lot, and it is true that English artists back then did very consciously go in and copy American recordings note for note. But, of course, the timbres of the players, and in some cases the rhythm sections, weren't quite as groovy. The English brass tone is also very distinctly different, and, of course, the recording studios were different as well. I definitely heard Anyone Who Had a Heart by Cilla Black first, and it became a number one hit in England before Dion's version was ever even heard there. And then I think both versions were in the charts. Then I heard Dusty Springfield's version after that. In England back then, Bert sometimes had two and even three versions of the same song in the
wow.
charts at the same time.
Loved them some Bert.
Really. They weren't really like what we would later call soul records, although the original versions were sung by African-American singers. The covers in England were sung predominantly by white singers, but people like Dusty and Cilla were great on those early records. I still really love Cilla's version of Anyone Who Had a Heart because she sounds so desperate in a great way, and that's a very profound song. Well, with Dion's next record, she made sure that this was going to be released and get to distributed in England before anybody had a chance to wreck it for her, and it did become her biggest hit to date. Probably the song that everybody remembers most that they associate with her. We'll end our show with this track by Dionne Warwick. Take care, everybody. We'll see you next week. Here's Walk On By.
If you see me walking down the street and I start to cry each time we meet, walk on by. Just let me grieve in private, 'cause each time I see you, I break down and cry. Walk on by.
Stop.
Walk on by.
Stop.
Walk on by. Broken and blue, walk on by, walk on by. Foolish pride, that's all that I have left. So let me hide the tears and the sadness you gave me when you said goodbye.